Last week, we considered an overview of chapter 8, which is the second speech from Lady Wisdom in the first 9 chapters of the parental lectures from father to son concerning wisdom. And we heard her say, last week, it was this extended call, a call to what? To hear wisdom, to hear her words that, as we see at the end of the chapter, lead to life. And we discussed that there's really 3 big pieces to the poem, to this call, and really each of those is one developed reason that we should listen. So the first reason in the first 11 verses was that wisdom speaks truth. We saw that particularly in verses 6, 7, and 8. Listen, for I will speak of excellent things, and from the opening of my lips will come right things, for my mouth will speak truth. Wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are with righteousness. Nothing crooked or perverse is in them. So her word stands from of old. It is true. It is straight. It is trustworthy. And then secondly, in verses 12 through 21, there was this development of her character, and she revealed that all of these virtues she has, she shares, right? She shares her treasure with those who hear her voice. So there were all sorts of elements there. It will come out this morning that one of the key pieces is that by me, in verse 15, kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me, princes rule and nobles, all the judges of the earth. And then the third portion, the third reason that we should listen to Lady Wisdom is that she sees totally. She has this sort of comprehensive knowledge. And we discussed the idea maybe of a recruiter or a salesman, if somebody's trying to pitch you on an idea so that you would listen to them. One of the things you want to know is how old are these ideas? How long has this person been doing this? And wisdom gives about as good an answer as you could, and that is that I've been there since before the beginning. I've been there since before the creation. And that's verses 22 through 31. So we didn't really develop that at all last week, look into the details, and that's really what we're here to do this morning. So why did we leave this piece on the table? For a few reasons. First, whether it should or shouldn't have been, this text has significant historical weight in the development of early Christian theology. And we'll get to that closer to the end. But there have been some misunderstandings from this text that prompted great conversations in the first few hundred years post-Christ. Secondly, the beauty of this text deserves some contemplation. We should look at the beauty of this poem and enjoy it. So I hope to do that this morning. And then thirdly, it does have a unique and previously underemphasized point of application to contribute to Proverbs 1 through 9, and that we will consider at the very end. So really the 3 steps are to look at the poem in detail, and then to consider some of the historical misuse of this text, and then to consider some application. So there's a lot on this, but we'll walk through it. Before we go through sort of the details of the text, I'll give you a moment to sort of orient yourself before we examine. But I want to discuss a few points about interpreting poetry. Poetry in general invites us to feel or to experience a text, a body of words. And biblical poetry, it invites us, if not requires us, to feel and experience specifically. It's not as though it's just a poem that you can read however you'd like or interpret however you'd like or feel or experience however you'd like. It's guided. There's an intended end for us because the feeling and the experience are tied to specific and objective meaning. So the road to understanding that meaning is paved with analysis. We have to look at it. Time and time again, we need to break it down, we need to put it in its component parts and understand the interpretation, right? This analysis leads to a right interpretation. So as we analyze and interpret a poem this morning, understand that there are two great errors, or probably more, but there's two great errors that often occur when it comes to poetic analysis. The first is, and this is probably more in general our, as in our sort of church's tendency, is that we would reach sort of cold conclusions. It's very strictly, our conclusions are very strictly related to the analytical breakdown of the text. We want the nuts and bolts, but we want to reduce it to what it actually means and just leave it there. We could really do without the poem, to be honest. I just want to know what the poem means. Once I know what the poem means, I know the right thing to think, which is very important. But the thoughts are supposed to then circle back and lead us to an improper emotion that the text is also intending to lead us into. One of the errors is just this sort of cold conclusions that are related to the technical language. You know, so what you're really saying is this. Okay, well then just why didn't you just say that in the first place? Because there's importance to the manner of communication here. The other error is that there's this sort of maybe wild wonder in a poem. I say wild in that it's not been contained by the objective meaning. It could be a number of motivations behind it. Maybe it's somebody that's sort of departing from the intention of the text in this mindless pursuit of the emotional experience, of this powerful response, this personal response to the language. Or perhaps, as we'll see happened in history, there's an overextension of the poetic language. You're now taking the poem to lengths it never was intended to go to. You're making it say things it never intended to say. So what we're seeking to do is walk this pathway of a good and right breakdown, analysis, a look at it, but that leads us to a full discovery even of the feeling of the text. There's this tension that's communicated in a poem that I absolutely love, by Billy Collins. It says about interpretation of poetry, "I ask them to take a poem and hold it up to the light like a color slide or press an ear against its hive. I say, drop a mouse in a poem and watch him probe his way out or walk inside a poem's room and feel the walls for a light switch. I want them to water ski across the surface of a poem, waving at the author's name on the shore, but all they want to do is tie the poem to a chair with a rope and torture a confession out of it. They begin beating it with a hose to find out what it really means." So you can see this tension, can't you? Because we can't just go water skiing outside of the intention of the text. Neither do we say it's not about that. It's not about any sort of feeling or emotion. It's just the meaning itself, that's all it is. So what we're intended to do is to engage the tools of analysis to enter into more profoundly into the meaning of the poem. So enjoy the beauty of this poem from Wisdom. The text on the screen is a combination of the New King James, which I read in its entirety this morning, and my translation of Proverbs 8. And I've blended the two intentionally to accentuate a few features of the poem that might otherwise be veiled. So sometimes in a poetic analysis, like as you're reading in Hebrew, you can see things very clearly that you want to communicate very clearly as much as you can in English. So that's what I've sought to do. So you'll see a few points, and I hope that they accentuate really what's going on. You may see a few points of divergence between what you read or what you have in front of you and what's up on the screen. So actually take note of those. I mean, you have the Bible in your hand, so compare what's on the screen with the text in your lap, and if you have any questions that remain unanswered after the sermon, then feel free to bring them up. Depending on the translation that you're reading this morning, you'll discover two particular moments in the text what you read might look far different than what's on the screen. The first, there's one at the beginning and one at the end. So it's the word here for possession, and then the word at the end, constantly. Those two things, and we'll walk through the various options that are there so that everyone sort of knows what other people might be reading and what I believe the interpretation is intended to be. So, the poem is divided into two pieces, two big pieces that are then further divided into two shorter pieces. You can see it's two lines, three lines, three lines, two lines. So let's just consider what's going on in this first five verses. In the blue and the red throughout the poem, you see in the blue wisdom's activity, right? She was possessed, she has been established, she was brought forth, she was brought forth, she was there, she was beside him. That's what wisdom's doing in the poem, or at the beginning, is even having done. It's passive in the first half. She's an observer that's being brought forth, and then she's active in the second half. I was watching, I was there, and then I was even celebrating. So that's what she's doing. And then the red is Yahweh's activity. So Yahweh is the one actively that possessed her or brought her forth at the beginning. And then you see the introduction to he made in verse 26, followed by the second half is all about his creative activity. He prepared, he inscribed, he established, he strengthened, he assigned, he inscribed, all of these things God is actively creating while wisdom observes and takes great joy. So that's what the blue and the red are, is the activity of really the two players in the text. The green is all of the words for the elements of creation that are being discussed in the middle of the poem. You see, it introduced the last word of verse 23, and then all throughout verses 24 through 26 and 27 through 29, a lot of creative language. So, what are the important pieces here? The first two verses are very temporal. So there are four temporal particles from. And that might be difficult to see in an English translation, but that is the time marker in the first two verses. And what is it connected to? What are these particles connected to? From all these synonyms of ancient ideas, from of old, from everlasting, from the beginning, from the earliest times. It's four different sort of synonyms for this idea that before the clock ticked its first second, that's when this was all taking place. So from of old. And that's reinforced by the two lines about Yahweh at the beginning of his way, the earliest of his works. And so we're supposed to look way, 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 way back, as far, even further back than we can see. That's how far back wisdom goes. So I think for the sake of more quick clarity, look at these first four ideas of wisdom together. So she is possessed by Yahweh here. Boy, I'm trying to get this to go away. Possessed, established, brought forth, brought forth. Now, all of those are working together, and what they're working together to do is to show us the metaphor of a birth. And I'll seek to persuade you of that as we go through. But this first one, Yahweh possessed me. So we start off with sort of a hotly debated verse. There are three different things that you might be looking at in your translation. The first is this idea of acquiring or possessing, and there's no argument about what the word is here. There's some argument about what the word is constantly at the end, but what the word is. It's all the same word. It's just, what does it mean? What is he intending? So the first idea is that he's acquiring or possessing something. It's the beginning of his interaction with it. And that's a very common way that this word is used. It's how it's translated here in the New King James. Another idea would be that he created wisdom, and that became particularly developed later in right at the turn of when Christ was born, in some of the intertestamental literature, and then through someone we'll talk about later, some of the Greek-speaking Jewish philosopher Philo. But that Yahweh created wisdom at the beginning of his way. Or the third idea is that that Yahweh begot her. That she was, you might say, conceived. And with all four of these working together, I think the intention in the poem is very crystal clear, that it is talking about this origination, but origination like we would think of conception. It's a little bit maybe provocative for us to say it this way, but in the poem, like, Yahweh's having wisdom as a child. And so he conceives her at the beginning of his way. That second, in verse 23, the second verb, I have been established, is this idea of being woven or knit or covered. And it is the word that's used in Psalm 139, where the psalmist says that you have formed my inward parts and you wove me in my mother's womb. Poetically here, it's, I believe, the idea of gestation. It's this growth in the womb of Yahweh. So she's been conceived and grown in his womb. And then in verse 24, I was brought forth. And this is the word for labor pains. This is the word for birth itself. And twice it says that I was brought forth even before any of these other things had happened. So it's seeking to show us that wisdom has come and was brought forth by God far before the world was ever made. From everlasting, from the beginning is the word for face, from the faced, from the very earliest times, from the farthest point east that you could ever get. That's when all of this was taking place. Verses 24 through 26 also have temporal ideas, six or five of them here. When there were no this, before this, before that, and then a very odd way of saying before, it's literally until not yet he made the earth. So you'll see various ways that that's communicated in English as well. So here, 24 through 26 is describing the negative state of creation. Does that make sense? That he's saying that it hadn't happened yet. It was before it had happened, right? That's when wisdom was brought forth, before the clock started ticking, before the world ever began, right? So when none of these things had taken place, and the way that he communicates it is he starts very low in all of the things that eventually were created, and he moves up a little bit higher. So when there were no depths, this is the word for like the primordial chaos, for the sea and all of its raging and roaring and foaming sort of realities, with the place of chaos, the place where there would eventually be these sea monsters and wild things that nobody could control, and many unexplored areas, like that, this terrifying reality that often in the Old Testament represents death and chaos. Before any of that took place, even before any of that sort of stuff made its way up through the fountains into this peaceful reality that we might know as streams or lakes and those sorts of things, before there were any peaceful channels of the chaotic depths up to the crust of the earth, before, in verse 25, the mountains were settled, and this idea is that the mountains are rooted into the sea. So we think of mountains like what's to our east, and that's not exactly what he's about here. He's actually about like an island that's very deeply buried in the sea. It's a rooted rock is the idea. So he says, before these rooted rocks that just make their way up to the surface were established, or before they were settled. And then he says, before the hills, and that would be more like how we might think of a mountain, you know, like something that actually protrudes from the earth's crust. Before the hills, she was brought forth. Before then, he made, and now that we're on sort of the surface of the created world, he describes in sort of concentric circles, I guess, this way in which it moves towards something that's very organized. In fact, it moves eventually to consider humanity itself. So before he made the earth, all of this surface, before he made the fields, which are the very cultivatable sort of places that we would live around and get our food from, before any of that, and then he says, before even the very first clods of dirt that make up that field, before the primal dust of the world. And that should lead us very clearly and poetically back to the creation account, where God made what out of the dust of the earth? He made us. He I need Adam. And so she's saying, before all even the sort of wild chaos of the first few days and then this progressive organization as he moves from the depths of the sea up to the fountains and streams and these mountains that then take place. And he says, and then we move sort of zooming across the earth to where we see the humans are cultivating. And then look, they're even born here. This is what they're made of. This is their cradle and their place of life. And eventually we know that they return to dust, don't they? It's their grave too. Before any of this dirt was made, I was born. I was there. One of Job's friends, Eliphaz, he accuses Job. He says, okay, Job, were you the first man born? Were you here before the hills? And the answer is no, of course. And he was intending to produce humility in Job. He was intending to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You don't have the answer that you think you do. But wisdom would say, yes, I was before all that. I was actually before the first man born. I was there before he was even dust. I was there before the sort of materials for the recipe were around. But passively, right? This conception, gestation, birth, all before creation. Now, 27 through 29 discuss the creation very actively. And here, both Yahweh and then in sort of an observation sense, wisdom, are both acting. So the language here is strong and magnificent. When he prepared, this is the idea of organizing and setting and settling, putting in place. When he prepared, and notice, now we're going to go from top down. Okay, so now we start in the heavens, and he's going to work his way back down to earth, the foundations of the earth. So when he prepared the heavens, when he set the very elevated parts in place, I was there. I was watching, I was enjoying, I was participating. And then it says, when he inscribed, and that's an important sort of distinction from, I think the New King James, drew out. It is true that it's this idea of, like, you could say coloring or drawing or writing, but the idea is that he's cutting it out. He's cutting this thing out. He inscribed a circle on the face of the deep. When we get to the end of this section, we'll talk about the significance here. But it's inscribed in 27, inscribed at the end in 29, and then there's another word in the beginning of 29 when he assigned to the sea its limit, that is, its inscription as a noun. So he has prepared the heavens. He's set them all in his place. And then he's actually written, he has drawn, but he's carved a circle on the face of the deep. This is the horizon that goes all the way around. So you have the heavens above and then this sort of line that goes all the way around the horizon. And then he establishes in that heaven the clouds. And they're not just any clouds. He's established this to mean he makes them firm or makes them strong. Which means they actually stay up there. Isn't that amazing that the clouds stay up there even when they're full of water? And that's what he gets at in the second line of 28. When he strengthened the foundations of the deep, he's sort of referring to this cycle of water. How does he fill and establish the foundations of the deep? Well, by sort of dumping water that's hanging in the sky like this ocean above. It's magnificent. So you've got the heavens and then the horizon and the clouds that are held up full of water. And then he assigns to the water below its limits. So there with this limit, you get the idea of carving again. There's a coastline involved. Like here's where you go, here's where you don't go. And the water just stays right there, doesn't it? Moves up to it, steps back away from it. Moves up to it, steps back away from it. These lines that God has drawn. He says the implication in 29 is so that the waters don't transgress his command or break his laws, cross his lines. And then this word for inscription again, when he inscribed the foundations of the earth. So three times in this text, he's inscribed something. He's inscribed a circle for the horizon. He's inscribed these lines on our earth for the sea. And then he's inscribed even the very base, like the foundations, the things, the pillars of earth. He's made it all. Now, what is that intended to cause us to think? And then you might say, and to feel. How are we supposed to respond to 27 through 29? Well, you see the supreme authority of Yahweh as creator, the designer, the establisher, the fashioner of all of these things. And this idea of inscription is key to that. So if you look back, the verses we referenced once at the beginning of this conversation is chapter 8, verses 14 and 15, or 15 and 16. He says, wisdom says, by me, kings reign, and rulers inscribe justice. By me, princes rule, and nobles, all the judges of righteousness. This is something, this inscribing is something that kings do. It's something that lawmakers do. It's something that designers do. It's something that people who are intending to bring order to chaos do. They make a rule. And here, Yahweh makes all the rules. He designs his world according to his mind. And he is no exception to any of these little human rulers, where he does so by wisdom. She is there taking great delight in all of these words, in all of these inscriptions. Think like the Ten Commandments inscribed into stone, a ruler cutting out a law that must be obeyed. Creation follows God's laws. It must obey. And we, as his creation as well, would do well to consider and to know and to understand and delight in these laws as well. So he is demonstrating his authority and rulership by or with wisdom, pointing back to 8:15. And isn't that that's a supreme example, isn't it? Wisdom saying, hear me, hear me, hear me. The rulers have ruled by me. Come to think of it, the supreme ruler of the universe rules with me, by me. So even the supreme sovereign has wisdom at his side. Then verses 30 and 31, then at that time, I was beside him constantly. Now here is another word that has, it's debated which word is intended. So it's not so much the meaning of this word, but which word is supposed to be in the content. So one of them is the idea of a master craftsman, and that's most likely what you're looking at, the idea of the wisest craftsman that ever would be. And we know that wisdom is related to this idea of skill, and that's where the idea of craftsman would come to play in this poem. Really, the issue is that God is very clearly displayed in 27 through 29 as the craftsman. It's not wisdom that's making. It's wisdom that's watching. She was there and enjoying and taking delight in what he was doing. So there's one text, an alternate reading that would say it's a nursling or a small child, like she was a little girl. And that pairs very well with this idea, doesn't it, that she's just been born. And so now in the created world, it's like she's a little girl and she's watching and like dancing and delighting and celebrating in what he's doing. And then now she's speaking in Proverbs 8 as a woman. Like, that whole concept makes a lot of sense. And then there's this idea, which is it's actually a word that would be an infinitive, so it would be to say to be firm or to be faithful, to be steadfast. And I think the best reading is probably a combination of the second two or the last one by itself. But this idea of constancy, for a few reasons. One, the nursling idea, the young girl idea, is difficult because the word is masculine. So that's a little bit tricky to like switch her gender there in the story. And then the idea of constancy, I think, is pretty strongly defended by everything that happens afterwards, that it's day after day. There's a constancy there, celebrating always before him. There's constancy in the fact that it was before the clock started ticking, constancy in the fact that it's always been the case. So she's always been sort of beside him and with him. If it's a master craftsman, if that is the correct translation, then we have to say she's a co-craftsman. Like she would we would have to say that she's sort of standing beside, even learning from him, poetically speaking, right? Watching and even as he makes, she says, wow, that's a tremendous idea. And she sort of adopts. She's like an apprentice becoming craftsman. So I think it's this idea of constancy, but you could debate it whenever you want. And what's she doing while she's ever there? And there's this A, B, so delighting, celebrating, and then back out, B, A, celebrating, delighting. And celebrating is a lot stronger word than rejoicing. It's a better word for what happens. This is what happens when they bring the ark back into Israel. Everyone's celebrating. There's this idea of music present. There's this idea of dancing present. It's more than maybe just a thought of thanksgiving or even taking joy in something. It's like it's demonstrated. There's a celebration. There's sort of a party that's taking place. And so she's delighting moment after moment, day after day, celebrating always before him. So he's sort of the point of the first line. And then as you exit the poem, you reverse the two images. And what is she celebrating and delighting? In the creation itself, namely the pinnacle of his creation, humanity. She's celebrating in the earth and in the inhabited, key word there, the inhabited world. My delight was in the sons of men. And now her relationship to us in Proverbs 1 through 9 becomes a little bit more clear. Why is she always after us? Why is she always calling? Because she has seen us from the beginning. She takes great delight in this whole story, in his magnificent creation, this image of God creation, the one that's intended to be the crowning jewel and the rulers. And we talked even on Wednesday night about these royal priests who are supposed to take his world and develop it and enjoy it. And that's what she is ready and willing and prepared to do. We're going to pause and come back to application. What do we do with this at the end? And I'd like to walk through one way in which this text has been, it was very significant historically. To a degree, just for awareness, some of you may already be aware, but so that we sort of know maybe where we came from or we know how this piece of Scripture has been a part of the story of Christianity. So historically, the church fathers, at the time of and immediately after Jesus, like it was a very quick thing, they are equating, as you may have wondered about, they're equating Christ with Lady Wisdom. So it's a conversation about the nature of this woman. Who is she intended to be? And maybe there are moments, you know, as you read through, you're like, man, that sounds kind of a lot like Jesus, or different points in the Scripture in the New Testament. And you might say, are they pointing back to something like this? It sounds a lot like Wisdom, and we've discussed this already, but historically, the church fathers are equating Christ with Lady Wisdom in Proverbs 8 particularly. How did this take place? Well, Philo, the Greek-speaking Jewish philosopher who lived during the time of Christ, probably a name you know, but that's when he lived, he wrote that the universe was fabricated through the agency of logos sophia, of word wisdom. This is the Greek words for word wisdom. And this connection between logos, or word, and sophia, wisdom, stuck. So much so that when many in the early church read a text like this, they're reading, they're saying, okay, so Yahweh possessed Jesus. Jesus was established. Jesus is brought forth. You can maybe see where this is going in a little bit of a potentially dangerous direction. When somebody would read something like John 1, in the beginning was the Logos, the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. They're connecting that very closely maybe to the origin account in Proverbs 8, the Logos and the Sophia. Or Colossians 1:15, which we read this morning. He is the firstborn of creation. And when we walked through that, now 2 years ago maybe, You notice some of the dangers of potential interpretation of firstborn of creation. But neither John in John 1 or Paul in Colossians are building their high Christology from Proverbs 8. I don't believe that they're doing that. But what happened with this idea? Well, in the early 300s, a man named Arius, who was a priest in Alexandria, he clashed with his bishop over this very topic, primarily the issue of whether the Logos and Sophia was co-eternal with God, or whether he was a created being. Arius was arguing that there was a time or material or God. There was when the Word was not. So there was something before the Word was. Taking the position that the Word was the first and the best of God's creatures. And his primary textual evidence, Proverbs 8:22. Yahweh created me. You see the issue with this text and perhaps even with that interpretation, taking that word as the semantic range of this Hebrew word. So Yahweh created me. And that's his argument. So as you can imagine, this sort of extension of this word wisdom union caused quite a stir as it undermined foundational Christian theology. This undermines Trinitary thought. This undermines Christ as God, which undermines soteriology. There's significant effects here. So as the noise of the contention grew, Constantine called for a council of the church leaders to settle the matter in a town called Nicaea. You may have heard of the Nicene Creed. And in 325, there was a great debate between Arius and Athanasius. And Athanasius was persuasive in the end, and the council, once they heard the arguments of Arius, were convinced against him, and they wrote the following: "We believe in one God, the Father Almighty, maker of all things visible and invisible, and in one Lord Jesus Christ, the Son of God, the only begotten of the Father, that is from the substance of the Father, God from God, light from light, true God from true God, begotten, not made, of one substance with the Father, through whom, Christ, all things were made, both in heaven and on earth, who for us humans and for our salvation descended and became incarnate, becoming human, suffered and rose again on the third day, ascended to the heavens, and will come to judge the living and the dead." And then another paragraph, he says, "But those who say that there was when he was not, Arius, and that before being begotten, he was not, or that he came from that which is not, or that the Son of God is of a different substance or essence, or that he is created or mutable, these the church anathematizes." They're speaking very strongly against his interpretation of Proverbs 8, but this was one of the first and greatest councils of the early church. And so you can see very clearly that their intentions to establish an early statement that rejected any notion that the Son or the Word, this Logos Sophia, was a creature or a being less divine than the Father. So, how do we think about the nature of Lady Wisdom in Proverbs 1 through 8? While there are numerous and striking points of connection between Jesus and wisdom, or even the Spirit of God and wisdom, we must observe the distinctions between them, which point to the superiority of Christ. So in this list, three are from a commentator, three are from me. These are a few reasons or points of distinction. God gave birth to wisdom, as the poem describes, poetically, but Christ is the eternal Son. Wisdom witnessed the creation. I was there, I was watching, but Christ is the Creator. Wisdom will laugh, back in chapter 1, at the time of judgment, but Christ is the judge. Wisdom is very clearly throughout wisdom literature described as limited, but Jesus is unlimited. Wisdom observes the brokenness of the world and humanity, but Jesus heals that brokenness. Wisdom offers a banquet of food and drink. We'll see that very clearly in chapter 9. But Jesus is the bread of life. You can see these like things that are similar, but the points of distinction are vast. So we should say with clarity and with confidence then, God is wise, but wisdom is not God. Any religious argument that Christ was created is the resurrection of this ancient heresy and has been clearly laid to rest by the scripture and by the gathered assembly of God's people. So we should watch for that error. Lady Wisdom emanates from and reflects the divine creator. She comes from God's essential being. She is, there's a quote, a revelation that has an organic connection with God's very nature and being. So with that in mind, these points of distinction particularly, what do we do with this poem as it relates to application? How do we go from here? Now, last week, we discussed that in chapter 8, sort of walked away thinking, okay, so there's this composite picture of wisdom. It's not just one voice that we're listening for, as though we would go and like listen to an audio recording of it somewhere, this grand speech. No. We noted a few fallible and a few infallible places that we would go to hear voice. But all of these are in the realm of sort of verbal revelation, aren't they? Places that are still word-related. And we know that that's not, even in the infallible category, like the scripture and Jesus himself, that those aren't the only places that God has revealed things, revealed himself even. And this is, I think, a good consideration for us, that this text proposes to us another place that we go to learn wisdom, and that is the creation itself, the created world. This is a very strong connection with wisdom literature. Where do we learn wisdom? One of the primary places we learn it, or ways that we learn it, is by observation. So one is by hearing what others have said, and one is by seeing. A few examples of that, right? Like Proverbs 6:6 earlier we read, go to the ant. Well, that's not anything like what we talked about last week. That's not a voice that's given to you that you listen to. Again, ants can't talk. So what are we going to do? We're going to observe the created world. Solomon says, go to the ant, consider her, and be wise. Learn from her. Or very clearly, the strong declaration of the two books of Revelation in Psalm 19, it begins, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. It displays his creativity and truth about him. Day unto day utters speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no language or speech where their voice is not heard. Their line is gone out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world. We're intended to look at his world and to learn about him. There we see the glory and the intention of the sovereign maker who carved decrees by wisdom. And he made all things good. So though creation now groans under a curse, it longs for redemption. It speaks still truly about him. And so as we'll sing in a moment, remember that this is our Father's world. And the rocks and the trees and the skies and the seas were wrought by his hand and instruct us concerning him. Whether that's the morning light or the lily white, they declare their maker's praise. So there's a reason that we are closely connected to this world. It was made for us. It's the perfect home for us, ideally, and will be eventually again. But it's this perfect home for us. So this idea of going on walks, loving camping, loving things about nature, loving animals, loving all like things like this, places where we go to see Him and to enjoy Him, that is good and right. And we do well to go to the ant and hear her sing of the one who established her by wisdom.